Good afternoon. It's good to see you all. As Roy said, we've been doing Practicing the Way, and someone asked me, you know, before church started how I am, and I said, I'm doing well, but I'm so sore because one of the changes I've been making after doing week two, which talked about just kind of looking at your life and their habits, I really wanted to start exercising. And so I've been meeting Eliza at the gym, and she's a fantastic friend because she's taking a very, very unfit, out of shape me and pushing me to work out, and it's been great. But I'm still sore from Monday's body pump class, so I am very out of shape. But it's been good. It's so good to see you. I just want to say a special welcome to Janice's parents. Not to embarrass you or anything, but I'm very, very glad you're here. So Janice's parents have been watching us online for many years now, I think. And it's always nice when someone that you know is watching online gets to see you in person and we get to see each other physically. Once in a while, I get contacted by people who do watch our live stream from all over the world. And I remember one person who is in a different state emailed me once and was saying how she is unable to go to church because of her work schedule and her commitments, but she listens to our sermon on our podcast, because did you know there is a podcast of the Melbourne City Adventist Church sermons? And so she listens to our podcast on her, she's got a long commute to work every day, and she was saying how it blesses her, and she just sent me a really nice note. And so it's always nice to know that. Those of you who are watching online, if you've been silent and invisible, I would love to hear from you, send a message just so that we can keep you in prayer. And you might have noticed that we've been praying for a Stephen from South Australia in our prayer, and you might be wondering, who's that? Well, he's one of the people who watches our stream online because he lives in a really remote place in South Australia where the nearest church is 3 hours away. And so he watches our stream, and that's his church. We keep in touch through Facebook, and he asked for prayer because of his his health at the moment. And so that's why we pray for him, knowing that he's watching, as well as many others. So it's good to have you here physically, and I know many people are sick as well right now with everything that's going around this winter. And so for those of you who are sick and watching online, we really hope and pray you feel better soon. Today is the final part, part five of our series that we have done on life lessons from philosophers and kings. And I've really enjoyed the research and the reading and the preparation, and I hope it's been helpful for you as well. We've been exploring the question, how do we find meaning in an absurd world, right? Because life is hard. Life can be chaotic. Life can be really senseless when bad things happen to good people. It makes us truly stop and think, well, what is the purpose of all this? How do we navigate this life when there's so much out of our control? And so we've looked at the life of King Solomon. We've talked about philosophers like Albert Camus and Augustine. And we've looked at specifically four books in the Bible that I believe kind of give different approaches and answers to that question of how do you find meaning in this world? For example, Proverbs provided us a partial answer to these questions by sharing overall general principles of cause and effect, right? A compass of principles to guide us, like signposts along the way. And how I suggested that Proverbs leaves that door open, not only pointing us towards a way, but ultimately pointing us to the way, which is Jesus. And I talked about how we are all spiritual refugees, how we're searching for a home that we have never known but long for. You know, I host a book club, and one of the books, I think Bron chose it for our book club, was No Friend by the Mountain, by an asylum seeker who was at Manus Island for a while, and he wrote this book from prison by texting the publisher in the end, line by line, secretly, and reading that book was just so heartbreaking and yet challenging and yet just really good in reminding me just, you know, how we get so comfortable in our lives and forget that this world is actually not a comfortable place. And we realize that when difficult times come to us too. But at the end of the day, this world is not our home. We are all spiritual refugees longing for a home that we have never known, because at the end of the day, there is no such home here on earth, a home where we can be completely safe, a home that where there is no sorrow and no pain. Ecclesiastes invited us to accept the disillusionment that comes when we navigate life and find ourselves burnt out, frustrated, and disappointed in our search for meaning. And I suggested that seeking meaning from achievements and activities and circumstances, it's all smoke and mirrors, and that we need to shift our perspective and recognize that the answer to that statement, all is hevel, all is vanity, all is meaningless, is the echo, all is grace. And we looked at Song of Songs and how it showed us who is behind that veil of life's greatest gift, love, and how God is the source of love, and how he is that flame of Yahweh that gives us that strength and that motivation and that gift of love to go through life. And then last time we looked at the book of Psalms and how that book written by David and Solomon and many, many other writers of poetry and songs, they wrote that book as they were navigating the circumstances of life. And so then we can use the book of Psalms to go through joys and sorrows, ups and downs of life, and realize that God is with us always. So then today we're looking at a story from the King of Kings, Jesus, a story that was written down by Luke, who was a physician and a companion of Jesus' disciple Peter, as well as one of the renowned Christian converts and theologians, Paul. So we're going to be looking at this story, often called the prodigal son, found in Luke chapter 15, I should say. And I just want to read the context of why this story was told. So Dr. Luke tells us in Luke 15, verses 1 and 2, that tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." So what's happening is that Jesus is spending time with people that Pharisees, who were the religious and political leaders of his day, and the lawyers, again, the social elites of the day, are looking at Jesus spending time with who they described as unworthy and undeserving, and who they had already written off, right? So they see Jesus spending time with them, and he's thinking, well, he was spending time with them, he must not really know what's going on, right? He's not spending time with the right crowd, which is us. And so they're grumbling. And so to this grumbling group of Pharisees and lawyers, Jesus tells three stories or parables. And we're going to be reading the third one. So bear with me as I read the story to you. So Jesus said, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them, and not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' So he got up and he went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of man was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. and so they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing, so he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. "Your brother has come," he replied, "and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has come back safe and sound." The older brother became angry and refused to go in, so his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, "Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him." "My son," the father said, "you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." There is so much to this story, and I have preached about it before. I want to focus today on the older brother. I want to look at the older brother and look at why he is so upset. Why is the older brother so angry? I want you to think about it for a moment. Why is the older brother so angry? I believe it's because there's many reasons, but if I could kind of, you know, funnel it down, I believe it's because he had a very inflexible framework of what was fair. A very strong sense of justice. Good things should happen to good people, and bad things should happen to bad people. Hard work should be rewarded, and the foolish decisions should be punished. His younger brother was always doing things and getting away with it, slacking off instead of working hard, sneaking things and not getting caught, thinking only of himself that were actually hurting other people. For example, demanding his share of the father's inheritance meant that they would have to divide up the property, right? Sell off the portion, which meant that they couldn't continue to make profit off of the whole land. It meant that they were losing potential capital. And now, not only did he take his share and leave the house, leaving the older brother to take care of the family, now this younger brother has the audacity to come home after having lost it all. Which means the younger brother is not going to be living off of the inheritance that the older brother has, right? Living off the land that belongs to him. The older brother has made himself the judge and jury, and he has concluded that his brother is simply unworthy. Unworthy of the celebration. Unworthy of his presence at that party. So the brother refuses to go inside, even though he was probably really hungry, having worked out in the fields all day. But out of principle, right? Because of his sense of justice, he thinks, "I'm not going inside. I am not going to join the party. I am not going to celebrate my brother's homecoming." But it's not just his younger brother that this older brother is mad at. The older brother is also furious with the father. His dad should have been tougher with his brother. He shouldn't have sold off the portion. When the younger brother asked for his share, his father should have said, "No, you wait until I die," right? "You wait until it's your time. You wait like everybody else." And when he came home barefoot and in rags, the father should have scolded him, put him in his place, made him work for his food and shelter, not given him his best robe, a ring on his finger, sandals on his feet, and then giving him a party. And that makes the older brother angry too. Why in the world did his father invite all the neighbors to come and see the shame that was brought upon this family by his younger brother who has squandered his wealth? It's one thing to throw a party for someone who's come back with success, right? Who has come back with accolades. But he came back barefoot and in rags, and his father throws him a party and invites all the neighbors to come and see. The older brother is furious with the dad. Not only is the younger brother unworthy, of celebration and acceptance. The older brother thinks that his father is now unworthy of respect and admiration. Do you know who he thinks is the only one who is worthy? Himself. Right? Because he had been faithful. Because he had stayed home. Because he had worked hard. Because he didn't waste money. He deserved a party. The younger brother had falsely followed the allure of freedom, fame, and fortune, and had found them wanting. And the Bible says that he had come to his senses and he came home. But here is the older brother who is still blind to his own true condition. Because the older brother is full of pride, a judgmental heart, anger and bitterness and resentment. If you look at what he says to his father, he says, all these years I've been slaving for you, right? Slaving for you. All those years he had been home, he didn't want to be there. He says, all those years you never gave me. And then he says, and then this son of yours, not my little brother, this son of yours, when he comes home, he gets a party. You see, the older brother had been home, but in his heart, he was far away from his father, far away from his brother, far away from everything that physically he was doing. But in his heart, in his mind, in his spirit, there was resentment and bitterness and anger and distance. And so for the second time that day, the father has to meet the son where he is. The father had met the younger one on the road and given him what he needed, which was food and shelter and acceptance. Now the father comes to his other son, meets him where he is outside of the house, and gives him reassurance and reward and a challenge to rethink. Notice how he says, my son, my son. When I'm upset with my boys, they don't hear my son. They hear Micah Kim, Joshua Kim, right? I say my son. When I'm feeling love and endearment towards them, right? When on Friday, Micah had chapel and his class was hosting, which means that their class, they do the songs and they kind of do an element of the chapel program. And so I knew his class was hosting, and so I went to see. And I didn't know that he was going to be the one in the middle holding the microphone. And he sang. And the whole class sang too, but like you could hear him. And I was so proud of him. And I messaged the people being like, my son, right? My son. Here is the older brother showing so much anger towards the father, so much resentment towards his little brother. And the father's response is not whatever his name was, but my son. For the second time that day, we see the father's compassion where he says, my son, reassuring him, you are with me always. Another way of saying that is, I am with you always. And then he goes on to remind him that he has a reward, that it's not true that he has never given him anything. Because the truth is, he says, everything I have is yours. There's the older brother complaining, saying, you've never given me a party with even a goat. And his father is like, hey, everything I have is yours. It was actually yours to begin with. You could have had many parties. You didn't have to even ask me for them because they're yours. And, you know, I love how the father reminds him, this brother of yours, right? He had said, this son of yours. And now he says, your brother, right? This is your brother. Has come home, and this is where he challenges his older brother now. He says, isn't it right for us to celebrate that your brother is safe and sound? Isn't it right for us to celebrate that he was lost and is found? This was a day before post mail. This is a day before, emails and FaceTime. They had no news of their son and brother for years. for years. So for all they knew, their son and their brother had died. And so for the father, he's saying, isn't it enough that he's home? Isn't it enough that he's alive? And the implication is, that is enough, not only for him, but also for you. You are enough. The father sees worth in both his sons because they are his children, not because of what they have or haven't done. The father loves both his sons simply for who they are to him, not for what they do for him. And the father extends compassion to both his sons, the one who left and did all the wrong things, as well as the one who stayed and did all the right things for the wrong reasons. The one who's ashamed and the one who is self-righteous. The one who failed and the one who failed to see. The father invited both into the house to share his joy over them. Not over what they had done or not done, but just his joy over them. And he's saying, come, come into the house. Did that compassionate invitation melt the older brother's heart? We don't know. The story ends here. Because Jesus cleverly talking to the Pharisees and the lawyers, the elite of society, who had a very strong, inflexible sense of right and wrong, who had a very strong, inflexible sense of deserving and undeserving, worthy and unworthy, he leaves this story unfinished because he's talking to them. And of course, the implication is they are the older brother. And it's up to them to finish the story. How would they respond to the father's plea to come inside? You know, for much of my life, I resonated with the younger brother. One, because I'm actually the younger sister. I have an older sister. And she's not like this older brother at all. But she definitely was the one who always did the right thing. And so she paved the path. And so even though I was an okay girl, like I did right things most of the time, compared to her, I felt like I was the prodigal one. Right? Her room was always clean. I remember when we were little, my mom bought us both matching white dresses. By the end of the day, somehow my sister's dress was even cleaner than when it began. My dress had stains, right? All kinds of things, like I had rolled in the mud or something. I don't know. Like my dress was dirty, right? And every time, you know, we shared a room our whole childhood. And so, you know, it was very, very clear which side of the room was hers. Because her bed was made, like she had, you know, her Bible open, that she had her devotions that day, and like she had her list of, you know, all the books that she was reading through, and it was very clean and neat and tidy and beautiful. And then there was my bed and my desk, and like I like organized chaos sometimes, and so my desk is, you know, books that are open to all the pages where I had like left off, you know, and like pencils and crafts I had started working on. And it was just my mom would just come in and be like, dear daughter, she would say. And so my sister, unlike this older brother in the story, loved me like so much. So she was always very good to me. But I always identify with the younger brother, not because of, you know, the relationship and all that, but just because I always felt like I needed to do better in order to prove myself, right? So once again, it wasn't because my parents said or did anything, like they loved me, but I always wanted to like, I felt like I had something to prove, and I felt like I wasn't good enough. And so, you know, even when it, you know, when it came to studies, even though I did well, it never felt like it was good enough. Like, if I got 99%, I'd be so disappointed because I didn't get 100. And of course, my sister not only got 100, she would get the bonus question right. So she would have like 103. It's like, ah, right? And my sister is 2 years older than me, but there was one time in high school where we actually were in the same class. We had AP physics together just because of the schedules. And it's one thing to be compared because of so for example, every time I went to class, teacher would be going through the roll. And then, you know, first day, and then she would get to Jinha Kim, and she would butcher my name, first of all. And then second of all, she'd be like, oh, are you related to Wonha Kim? And I'd be like, yes. And she would be like, oh, I expect great things from you. And I'd be like, ah, right? And so it's enough to be compared, like, after a couple years. But to be in the same class with her was, like, another level of stark reality for me. Which felt, and it's not even reality, because, right, we both were, like, she was number one and I'd be number two. And so you would think, oh, like, I did well. No, it didn't feel like it, right? Number two didn't feel good. And so even though I did well in school, I'm not kidding you, I thought I was dumb. Like, I thought I wasn't smart. Like, it, you know, I would say, oh, my sister's really smart. But I would never describe myself as smart, right? Because in my mind, it just wasn't good enough. And, you know, she went to Princeton University, I went to Princeton University, but in my mind, I got to Princeton University somehow through luck. Somehow, like, I had, you know, deluded and deceived the admissions team, and they didn't really know. Like, I felt like an imposter. I did. Before imposter syndrome was a thing, I had it. And so I went to university, and, you know, I did my studies, and I remember there are scholarships you can apply to. I remember applying for a scholarship and writing, like, in one of the essay questions, it was like, oh, you know, what is your dream or blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, I love writing. I want to write a book. I want to blah, 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 blah. And I remember the person, the scholarship, committee person who decides these things, like, called me in and she was like, you know, she's like, you say your dream is to be a writer. You need to write better then. Let me give an example of how you should write. Boom, here's an application from last year. And guess what name is on that application? Wonha Kim. And I was like, she's like, can you write more like this? Right? And so my sister is the most loving, like, she thinks, she's like so affirming, she's fantastic. So once again, this is not my sister's fault, this is not my parents' fault. This is just in my own mind. This is in my own brain where I had this thought that I'm just not good enough, right? And so partly because of that, but partly because I live in a world and there's temptation and sin, after I graduated from uni, or even during uni, I just wanted freedom. Freedom from my family, right? Freedom from some of the principles I had been taught to uphold in my life. And long story short, I too have experienced incredible grace of forgiveness and compassion and experiencing that feeling of I was lost, but now I'm found, I'm saved, right? And so I experienced our prodigal sons returning home. And so most of my life, I identified with the younger brother. But you know what happened as I've gotten older? I find myself impatient with other people. I find myself being like, why did they do that? What are they thinking? Right? I find myself closing my heart and judging others. I find myself doing the right thing with the wrong spirit. I find myself relying on my own strength and my own capacity to get things done. I find myself thinking, why don't they get it? This is so easy, right? I find myself feeling entitled and forgetting to be grateful for what I already have. I find myself letting bitterness and anger build up in my heart, feeling distant from God and yet not wanting to come closer because I'm afraid to confront the pride that's there. And yet, to this version of me, God comes to me where I am and he says, my daughter, you have been with me always. I have always been with you. And everything I have is yours. My spirit, my power, my life, my love, my throne. It's all yours. Won't you come home? And he waits for me to say yes. To let go of my pride and my need to be right. To let go of my insecurities, which, you know, it's funny with insecurity. You go from one extreme to the other, right? It's so hard to find that balance where you feel less than, unworthy, then you feel better than, right? And deserving and entitled. And God invites us to let go of both grasping of identities and to see ourselves as children of God, worthy simply for being his child, worthy simply for being alive. Do you remember Simone Weil, whom I mentioned in the very first part of our Far Part series? She was a philosopher whom the better-known philosopher Albert Camus called the only great spirit of our time. She was born in France to a secular Jewish family who were Jewish by heritage but didn't practice religion. But one thing their parents did was they ensured that their children were well-educated. They tutored Simone and her brother André in mathematics, science, literature, and languages. By age 6, Simone was already reciting ancient Greek poetry and debating the theories of physics with her brother. The genius siblings grew up to discover truth each in their own ways. André grew up to be one of the most influential mathematicians in the 20th century. Simone grew up to be a social and political activist. She was fighting against the Nazi regime. She was siding with the working poor. She went into the Spanish Civil War. Wherever there was need and vulnerable people, she was there. And in fact, she died very young at 34 because she refused to eat more food than what the Germans were giving the French prisoners back at home. And so she was in England, and it was her choice. She wanted to show, it was her protest. And so she died of malnutrition. And it wasn't until after her death, many years after her death, that her writings were discovered and published. And her writings have impacted fields of philosophy, sociology, theology. And like I said, Albert Camus was just astounded by her writings. Simone actually converted to Christianity. And what led to her conversion was a series of small and yet significant moments over a span of years. For example, one time she was on holiday in Portugal, and there was a procession of villagers walking, singing a hymn. And something about that hymn and the power of that music just it made Simone pause, and that was the first time she felt something. And then years later, she went inside a church and prayed for the very first time. And something about that prayer, she experienced something that she couldn't quite explain, and she later wrote to her brother, her mathematician genius brother. She said, I agree with Pythagoras, and she had this whole theory about Pythagoras and God. And she said, I agree with Pythagoras that God was not algebraic, but geometric. Go and think about that for a while. A year later, while reciting a poem by George Herbert, she understood, Jesus died for me. And so it took many years and strange little moments that combined, and later she actually did get baptized and she became a Christian. In one of her writings, she said, we possess nothing in the world. A mere chance can strip us of everything except the power to say, I. That is what we have to give to God. In other words, to destroy. There is absolutely no other free act which it is given to us to accomplish, only the destruction of the eye. In other words, a global pandemic, a tragic accident, something can wipe away all our best laid plans, right? Something can come and in a moment, all our accomplishments, all our intellect, it can go like that. The only thing that we truly have is our will, the power to say I. And that is the hardest thing to give up. To say to God, I yield my life to you. I surrender my heart to you. I want you to guide me. That surrender is so difficult because we think it means a loss of our freedom, a loss of our identity. But that's not what happens at all. when we give God our will and we say, God, I want you in my life, God says, my son, my daughter, all I have is yours. It's not that we give everything up to God. We do. But it turns out God has already given everything to us, including his son Jesus, who has given his life so we can live. And it's only when we're willing to take that step of faith and say, okay, God, I trust in you, that we realize that God has had our back all along. That God has been the one who has been always with us, leading us to that point. When we yield ourselves to God, we don't lose our identity. We gain an identity that can never be shaken, where it's not based on how smart you are, how successful you are, or how many friends you have. Your identity, unshaken identity, is in the fact that you are God's child. And that alone is worthy of his love and all of the resources of heaven being poured out for you. When we acknowledge that God is God and that we don't have all the answers, that's the moment that we're taking that step and saying, I am giving you the I, right? I'm wielding my will, saying, okay, God, I don't know, but you know. It's acknowledging that all the lessons we've learned from philosophers and kings is telling us that life is actually impossible to navigate without this epiphany that Jesus is the way home. That our knowledge, our education, our wisdom, they're not going to give us true meaning. Our good works, our right beliefs, and our good character even is not going to give us meaning. Because in time, we might become like the older brother, resentful and closing our hearts slowly to others. We already know from the younger brother that traveling and entertainment and pleasure and indulgence and riches, they're not going to make us happy in the long term either. And so how do we navigate this world? How do we find meaning in this absurd life? And the answer is taking that step to enter the Father's house. In Milan, there's a huge cathedral called the Duomo, the third largest cathedral in the world. It was built in 1386 over the ruins of another church that was there many centuries ago. From the 4th and 5th century, that's when churches were first built, because Christianity was a persecuted religion until Emperor Constantine converted and he made Christianity the state religion of the Roman Empire. So then they started building churches. But before that, they met in homes and caves and mountains. So the first church that was built in this location was where the early Christians from the 3rd and 4th and 5th centuries were baptized. And over the ruins of those churches, many cathedrals were built, and that was the case with this one. But if you go under the ground of this cathedral, the ruins of the previous church from the 5th century is still there. And this is the baptistry, where scholars believe that Augustine and the other Christians who formed the theology that we have today from the Bible, that this is where they were baptized. This is the baptistry of the ruins of the earlier church. And if you go above this area to the cathedral, there are tourists streaming through. And there's this one quiet section of the church that has a sign. And the sign says, "Area reserved to worshipers. Please, no tourists. Do not go beyond this point except for confession." And in his book On the Road with St. Augustine that I started reading at the beginning of our series and now I've completed, James Smith writes this, describing this scene. He says, "You reach a point on the road with Augustine where mere tourism comes to an end. You're faced with a choice. Do you want to step in there? The next step isn't arrival. It's not the end of the road. To make that step won't solve all your problems or quell every anxiety, but it is the first step of giving yourself away. Arriving at the end of yourself and giving yourself over to the one who gave his life for you. It is the first step of belonging to a pilgrim people who will walk alongside you, listen and share their stories of the God who doesn't just send a raft, but climbs onto the cross that brings us back." The God who not only meets us running halfway up the hill towards home, but comes to wherever we are, outside the house, on the road, across the sea, and lays down his life and says, climb on me, let me take you home. The God who not only is preparing a home for us, he said, in my Father's house there are many rooms, space for all. But he is the God who makes a home in us. In Revelation chapter 3, verse 20, Jesus says, here I am. I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in and eat with that person and they with me. There's a feast to be celebrated. There's a reunion to attend. And God is extending that invitation to all of us. Whether we've wandered away like the younger brother or have been prideful like the older brother, we are all extended mercy. We are all given the invitation to let go of our own way and to come home to the Father. To not just be a tourist looking in, but a worshiper confessing. To not just be a visitor peering through the windows, but to say yes to being family and sitting at the table with God and with the other spiritual refugees coming home. Perhaps you have been like the older brother in the story, angry with God and others, struggling to understand and accept his love. Perhaps you've been like the younger brother, seeking for happiness in all the wrong places. I want to give you an invitation today to take that first step towards God's house and God's family. I want to invite you to give up the works-based, merit-based framework and our critical and unloving attitude towards others and accept that we too need mercy. We too need grace. Perhaps you need to take a step back home after having turned your back on him and you want to come back and recommit. Whether it's the first step or just the next step, I want to invite you to make a decision today. We're going to have a closing song. And during or after the closing song, when you're ready, when you're comfortable, after the prayer, I'm just going to be here in this little pocket. And so if you feel God prompting you to take that first step of baptism, it's the beginning of the journey, not the end, where you just say, yeah, actually, God, I want my identity to be so firmly rooted in being your child and being part of God's family. I'm tired of the anger. I'm tired of the self-reliance. And you want to take, that step in baptism. Or like I said, perhaps you've been baptized, but you have turned your back and you have left home and you want to recommit to coming back. You can also come and join me there. Or perhaps like the older brother, you have found yourself being judgmental, of being unloving and unkind, and you want to commit to receiving God's love and mercy and forgiveness for you, but also extending that compassion towards others. I want to invite you to also join me, and we're going to have a time of prayer together in our group after the service ends. So I'm going to invite Emran and Lorraine and Aaron to lead us in our closing song. So if you could all stand, and whenever you're comfortable, whenever you're ready, you can come to this area here. Pray with me. Father God, I pray that if there's anybody here who is hesitating about that decision, that you'll give them courage to make that step. And I pray that all of us in our hearts and all of us watching online would hear your invitation to come and be accepted, to come and be forgiven, to come and be affirmed that we are family. I pray, Father God, that you would help us in navigating this life and finding meaning, to recognize that that longing in our hearts that nothing else can fill is exactly that call from you to come and be found. And so I pray for your spirit to keep calling us and for us to be able to keep saying yes. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.